From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the remarkably welcoming Argo Studios in New York City. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners, and we're so thankful for that. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Merry Christmas! Although the commercial part of the holiday ended abruptly on December 25th, we're free to observe the 12 days of Christmas right into the new year. I do hope this season gives you the opportunity to spend time with family and friends and to start 2015 rested and reconnected with those who matter most. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief.
What I like to say is I like to say that skepticism is my nature, free thought is my methodology, agnosticism is my conclusion after 25 years of being in the ministry, and atheism is my opinion.
Last year you met Jerry DeWitt, the improbable founder and leader of the Community Mission Chapel, a humanist congregation making its improbable home in Lake Charles, Louisiana. For a look at how this congregation is observing Christmas this year, I'll welcome Jerry DeWitt back to State of Belief on this week's show.
You know, I find a lot of turmoil when you try to be sincere about your faith and make it all fit. And there's a peace that comes when you accept paradox. And you accept the fact that you don't have to know everything or beat yourself to death in order to, quote, believe correctly. Because as I read the Gospels, I don't see the imperative being correct belief. I see the imperative being how you treat other people.
Earlier this year, a remarkable book appeared that I've wanted to share with you for quite some time now. It's titled, Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God: How to Create Beauty, Give Love, and Find Peace. And on this week's show, I'll spend some time with the author, artist, and writer Frank Schaeffer. But first,
they wrapped the baby up in warm clothes and laid him in a manger filled with straw. Meanwhile, on the hills outside of Bethlehem, some shepherds who were watching over their sheep noticed a bright light in the sky. An angel appeared and told them not to be frightened. Instead, they should be happy, since a very special baby had been born, who was the Son of God.
Just in time for Christmas, the Pew Center's Religion and Public Life Project has released what I find a fascinating survey of American beliefs around this unique holiday. Massively commercial, ubiquitous in our secular culture, deeply significant for Christians in religious terms, what does Christmas really mean to us as Americans? Well, here with some answers is Jessica Martinez, research assistant at the Pew Forum. Dr. Martinez, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, I have to confess, I was really quite surprised at the percentage of Americans who say they believe the Christmas nativity story is literally true. Highlight some of those numbers for us, if you will.
Sure. So we asked people about a few of the elements of the Christmas story and did find widespread belief that these are events that took place. So about three-quarters of U.S. adults believe each that Jesus Christ was born to a virgin, that an angel appeared to shepherds to announce his birth, and that wise men guided by a star brought him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. And about 8 in 10 believe that Jesus was laid in a manger as a newborn baby.
Now, I have to ask, was the sample group exclusively Christian?
Nope. This was a sample of the U.S. general public of adults, so people 18 years of age or older. And so those figures that I just gave you include all adults. So if you look at U.S. adults overall, 65% of Americans believe all four of these events took place. Mm-hmm. And if you look just at those who identify as Christian, then that number is even higher. Fully 8 in 10 believe that all of these elements of the Christmas story are things that took place.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fascinating that on the specific question regarding baby Jesus being laid in a manger, even among those who seldom or never attend church, 64% say that story is literally true. Why do you think that was the highest response question as opposed to, say, the three wise men or the virgin birth?
That's a good question. And, you know, I can't say for sure what people were thinking when we asked about these, but the question about the baby Jesus being laid in a manger is sort of the one out of these four events that doesn't necessarily involve a religious element. So people can maybe believe that these circumstances took place, whereas they're a little more skeptical about an angel appearing or a star appearing to guide people to the place of Jesus' birth.
Now, you may not can tell me this, but were you all surprised by the results?
Well, most of these questions we hadn't asked before, so we weren't entirely sure what to expect, but we did ask last year the same question about whether people believe that Jesus Christ was born to a virgin, and we actually found nearly exactly the same results this year. So even, you know, last year just asking the one question, we sort of knew what to expect from that one, and then we found very similar results when we expanded the questions to include these other elements of the Christmas story.
So I think you've answered really anticipating my next question, and that is there lineage here so that we could see any changes in these numbers over time? But last year really is really what we have to work with.
Right. Last year's the first time we asked about the virgin birth, and this year's the first time we asked about these other elements. So it's something we'll have to take a look at in the future to see whether these beliefs change over time or remain consistent.
Jessica, you also ask about religious displays in public spaces. What were some of the key findings there?
Yeah, so we found many Americans are okay with religious holiday displays on government property in at least some case. So this includes 44% who say Christmas symbols like nativity scenes are okay on government property, whether or not they're accompanied by symbols of other faiths, and another 28% who say Christmas displays are okay, but only if other faiths are also represented alongside them. And then 20% say no religious symbols should be allowed at all on government property.
What was the opposition at one end of the scale as strong as support was at the other end of the scale?
Well, you bring up an interesting point, which is you can kind of look at these results in a couple of different ways. So on the one hand, like I said, a majority of Americans, almost three quarters, think these displays are okay in at least some cases. So that's including those who say they're okay on their own or those who say there should be other religious symbols alongside them. But if you look at it in another way, you could note that nearly half of Americans express at least some reservations about these displays. So that includes, again, those who say they should only be there if there are symbols of other faiths as well, and those who say there shouldn't be any symbols at all. So it kind of depends on how you look at the data.
Well, you know, I'm interested in the fact that Pew has been among the leading finders, I will say, for the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, in our land. Documentation of young people in particular leaving houses of worship over various concerns. Do you have any hunch as to how those two realities relate here? They would seem to be contradictions, but they're obviously not contradictions. Have you all talked about that? The nuns have a lot of criticism of houses of worship, what goes on there. We've seen a lot of people, young people in particular, moving away from houses of worship. They're is a widespread, somewhat cynicism, I would say, related to perspectives on religion in the nation. And yet here is just an overwhelming kind of affirmation of the nativity story where none of that shows up. It just baffles me.
Yeah, so the nuns are really an interesting group. So you mentioned, you know, part of the story is that a lot of people who don't identify with religion in the United States are maybe skeptical of religion or of religious organizations. But this group also does include people who are still religious on some level, who still might hold religious beliefs and even participate in some religious practices, but don't necessarily identify with a particular religion. So we see on this question of religious displays that among the unaffiliated, you know, there's a somewhat higher share who say no religious symbols should be allowed than you see among affiliated Americans, but there's still some support for allowing these symbols on mm-hmm. on government property. And I think it kind of speaks to the fact that Christmas in particular is a holiday in this country that is both religious and cultural. Mm-hmm. And there are many people who celebrate Christmas who don't necessarily participate in Christian religion to right. the same degree during other times during the year. So we know from last year when we asked people if they were planning to celebrate Christmas, 9 in 10 Americans said they were celebrating. And so, mm-hmm. you know, that it has to include at least some of the religiously unaffiliated as well.
Jessica, based on your polling, what do folks most look forward to during the Christmas season?
Yeah, so we asked about a few different activities associated with the holidays and how much, if at all, people are looking forward to it. And what really stands out as things that people are looking forward to are visiting with family and friends and eating holiday foods. So 3/4 of Americans said they're looking forward a lot to visiting with their loved ones during the holidays, and 6 in 10 said they're looking forward a lot to eating holiday foods.
You know what? It's even higher among the people in the studio where I am. It's the numbers are much higher. was there anything else in this survey that you found surprising or particularly significant?
Well, one other interesting thing that we haven't touched on yet is sort of the mixed feelings that people have about gift giving during the holiday season. Hmm. So we found, you know, most people say that when they think about buying and receiving gifts, it makes them feel joyful and it makes them feel generous. But there are many who also say it makes them feel stretched thin financially. Mm-hmm. You know, just over 1/3 say it makes them feel stressed out, and 1/4 even say the thought of exchanging gifts makes them feel wasteful. So overall, a little over 1/2 of people expressed both some positive and some negative feelings about gift giving during the holiday season.
I tell you what, this survey offers, I mean, it is just begging for more research and getting some answers as to why some things we wouldn't expect are there and some things we wouldn't expect are there. Dr. Jessica Martinez is a research associate at the Pew Forum for Religion and Public Life. I bet it was fun working on this one.
It was.
You can read the Christmas report online at pewforum.org. Jessica, this is such an interesting food for thought polling report. Thank you for doing it, and thank you for being with us today on State of Belief.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Frank Schaefer is a popular public speaker, a sought-after artist, and the author of the book, Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God: How to Create Beauty, Give Love, and Find Peace. With a heartfelt endorsement of all three of these goals, I'm very pleased to welcome Frank Schaefer to State of Belief Radio. Frank, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You have a fascinating history. I'd like for you, if you would, to start with just a quick summary of your relationship with organized religion.
Well, it's a complicated one. Let me just give you a thumbnail sketch. When I was a child, I was growing up in Switzerland, and my parents were Americans, Francis and Edith Schaefer, and at that time they founded a little ministry called Le Brie Fellowship, and we're talking back in the 1950s. And we were just a struggling missionary family. Dad was a Presbyterian minister. He was fundamentalist in his views, and had gone over to Europe after World War II to work with kids in the bombed-out cities. If you fast forward from that period to the present, today he's remembered as one of the founders of the religious right in the 1970s and 80s. And what happened in between is that he wrote books like The God Who Is There and Escape from Reason, and became better known in evangelical circles. And then I helped him in the 1970s make two film series, How Should We Then Live, which was on art and culture and theology, and then Whatever Happened to the Human Race, featuring Dad and Dr. C. Everett Koop, who then became Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General. And that film is really credited with being the foundation of the evangelical wing of the anti-abortion movement. In between those two kind of extreme events, the Ministry of Labrie had grown and really become a haven for people seeking intellectual answers to questions about faith. And so if you had checked in the 1960s, for instance, you would have thought you were in some sort of evangelical hippie commune. I mean, we're talking about the time when people were backpacking to India, the Beatles were with the Maharishi, looking for spiritual answers. That was the climate at that period, and Dad was this character who really almost became a guru, if you like, to seeking people, both Christian and non-Christian, who came through. And the only reason he's remembered as someone really on the right of the political spectrum is because of the strong stand he took on the issue of abortion, against the legalization of abortion. Otherwise, my father was very interested in the arts and in culture. You know, he would have been one of the first people to give lectures on Bob Dylan back in the days when nobody was really taking him any more seriously than other rock, pop, and folk stars. Dad was someone who always had a stream of artists and interesting people through Labrie. For instance, Timothy Leary came and stayed. Mm. Barbara Bush came and stayed. We had Jack Kemp, and who went on and became a vice presidential candidate, was a friend of our family. So I grew up as kind of part of a missionary family in my childhood, but then in my teenage years became really involved with my father in a kind of a nepotistic sort of relationship, which is really strange thinking back on it, but is very typical in many evangelical circles, where sons and family members follow their parents into the ministry. You know, the same thing happened with Pat Robertson and Dr. Dobson and many, many others. And so for about 10 years of my life, I was really involved during the period when he was very well known on the evangelical right. And so, for instance, if I look back at that time, believe it or not, I was flying around the country in Jerry Falwell's borrowed jet. I gave a keynote address to the Southern Baptist Convention and the religious broadcasters and on and on and on. And then when my dad died in 1984, I really began to consider the fact that I had kind of backed into this role and that really it was not what I felt called to do with my life. I had really become disenchanted with the direction of the religious right. I was beginning to have grave doubts about the kind of literalistic interpretation of Christianity that I had been raised on. And by the time 1990 rolled around, I had really left the evangelical community. And so the new book, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, is really about a spiritual journey away from fundamentalist Christianity I was raised on towards a much more mystical, open, and embracing view of both God and life and people. And I guess what I'm trying to do with the book is really open the door to embracing paradox and questioning as a good thing, rather than as something to be feared, as I would have thought back in my more fundamentalist days. So my connection with evangelical Christianity is through my family. It's through the work I did as a younger man, and more recently through some of the blogging and writing and opinion pieces I've written on the relationship of faith and politics. But, hey, I'm 62. I have 3 grown children, 5 grandchildren. So we're talking about a span of time here, not something that just happened 2 minutes ago. And that's really the perspective I bring to the book.
Well, I am intrigued, first of all, by the book's title, An Atheist Who Believes in God. Did that originate with this book, or is that a concept that goes back farther than that?
Well, I think a little bit of both. I mean, if you look at the book itself, what I'm trying to do, and for people who read Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, they'll see one of the threads running through it. I'm telling stories about my family and my grandchildren, relationships, faith, and so forth. But one of the threads that runs through it, I think, is really that I'm an anti-labeling kind of person. And I'm someone who says, hey, listen, you know, we are all much more complicated than our labels. So people call themselves atheists, and then sometimes they pray, or sometimes they're evangelists, like Billy Graham, who is a family friend, but who would tell my dad in private that he'd feared dying and he had a lot of doubts. Or you have a lot of ministers who are getting up in the pulpit every Sunday, but who will tell you privately that if they could figure out how to earn their living a different way, they would be saying something different. But they don't, because they don't want to be kicked out of their job. And, you know, far from this being hypocrisy, in fact, everybody's in that same place. I'd say, you know, to be to be perfectly frank, something I say in the book is that really when you come to labels, I've never met anybody who is really what they say they are in the sense of what the label conveys. So really, I've never met an atheist, I've never met a Christian, I've never met a Hindu, I've never met a Jew. For that matter, I've never met a man or a woman, as the label is used. I've met people who struggle, who are on a journey, who change their minds, who are different, say, when they're 62 than they are when they're 20. And that's not just about religion, it's about everything. I mean, take me, I got my girlfriend pregnant when we were 17 and 18 in Le Brie Fellowship back in the day. And Jeannie and I now have been together 45 years. We're totally different people than we were when we were kids. And I'm a completely different sort of a grandfather than I was a father. And yet you could say, well, it's all Frank Schaefer, but it isn't. The label, you know, if you had stuck me with the label of who Frank Schaefer was at 19 or 18 and who he is at 62, it's completely different. So both life's journey and the ambivalence and the contradictions and the paradox we find in our own views, not to mention the fact that we're never completely certain about everything, and if we are, then we're kind of certainty addicts, but that's not actually the same as knowing something. So I think the first thing to say about why I'm an atheist who believes in God is the title tries to actually embrace the fact that we're all much more complicated than our labels. And I invite people to look at who they are from a human perspective, not from a labeling philosophical or political perspective. And those are really two different things. And it's not just about religion. I'd say the same thing about Democrats and Republicans, right and left, liberal and conservative. These are all lousy ways to try to sum up a complicated, ambivalent person who's on a personal journey of age and growth and learning. I think we deserve better. So I'm trying to deliberately provoke a discussion with that title, saying, how on earth can you be that? Precisely because I want to answer, hey, listen, like everybody else, when we're honest, it depends on what day you catch a person and what mood they're in and what stage of their life they're at. And it's not just titles like Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. You could write the same thing about marriage, you know, why I'm in love with my wife and sometimes can't stand her. Well, anybody who's really been married for 45 years knows that that's closer to the truth than saying, oh, well, I love my wife all the time. And I think the same goes for faith, and it goes for child raising, and it goes for how we look at our communities. You know, this is all a journey, and it's a growing process.
Frank, this book obviously has been in you a long time. When did you decide you had to get it out, and what was the process of writing it?
Well, you know, I write for a living, and I've had some bestsellers, and I've had some other books that sink like a stone thrown into a deep pond, and all points in between. But this particular book came out of a real correspondence with people that developed after I wrote a memoir called Crazy for God, and the subtitle of that memoir was kind of provocative, how I grew up as one of the elect, helped found the religious right, and lived to take all or almost all of it back. And that really charted the journey of my religious family, the Schaefer family, from kind of obscurity to leaders in the religious right and why I left. And that book generated a very interesting correspondence from atheists like Christopher Hitchens, the author, who is now dead, of course, but he emailed me telling me how much he liked my writing, and we caught into a little correspondence. And then evangelicals who I'd known back when I was in the religious right myself. And oddly enough, a lot of the letters all sort of were the same. Our emails were the same. We like your book, but we're disappointed with how it ends. And in Chris Hitchens' case, it was he wanted me to declare myself an atheist. And in the case of the evangelicals, a clear declaration that I was still considered myself a Christian. And of course, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God came out of an attempt to explain to both camps, if you like, that I really don't believe in these watertight definitions and camps, and that for myself, this journey of spirituality, trying to follow Jesus, considering myself a believer, at the same time someone who really takes into account the not just the secular arguments, but a sense that we are, if I could put it this way, biological machines, and yet at the same time we look at the world through spiritual eyes, these things can't be reconciled. It isn't like there's a quick fix or an answer. So yeah, brain chemistry controls our lives. And at the same time, when we pick up a grandchild and we tell her or him that we love them, we mean it and we sense something far more than just simply genetics. And that's the human paradox. And so I found myself writing to people trying to explain that I thought that really spirituality can't be put in a special category. It's like everything else in life. It's part of a journey and we learn as we go. And a lot of time the answer is you can't know. There isn't an answer. And so you have to deal with that. In the same way, there's no guarantee you're going to stay married or in love, or that someone won't have an accident, or that you're going to live forever. You know, this is what mortality means, and we have to deal with that. And so my book, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, came out of a real and vivid correspondence with literally thousands of readers who were reacting to my memoir, Crazy for God. And I sat there for 6, 7, 8 years writing these emails, and eventually thought, hey, you know, if they all want to know what I believe at this point and why, and I keep trying to give the same answer in different ways, I think there's a little book here. And so it didn't come out of a vacuum. It came out of the real correspondence with a lot of people who were on a journey who, for instance, many of them would describe themselves as survivors of religion, mm-hmm. or former evangelicals or Roman Catholics, or even former practicing Jews, whatever it may be, who have really looked at the choices they're given between this kind of black and white version of religion where you're in or you're out, or black and white atheism where you're an atheist or you're not, and they reject it. Mm-hmm. They feel a spiritual dynamic in their life, and at the same time they're thoughtful people and they accept science and all these other things. And so this book did not just sort of come out of thin air. It came out of a genuine correspondence with people who have real questions. And I have to say that since the book has come out, I've never had a book generate email and Facebook correspondence like this one. So many people tell me, hey, at last someone has said the way I feel. I refuse to be put in an easy category. And thank you for being willing to embrace paradox and hold it up as something good rather than as something to be worked through until you get to a true answer. Maybe the true answer is paradox.
Frank Schaefer is an artist, public speaker, writer. I'll bet you he has sold you on this, and you need to read this book. The book is titled Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Create Beauty, Give Love, and Find Peace, came out earlier this year. You may want to pick it up right away. This is really thought-provoking work. And Frank, I appreciate so much you taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Hey, it's really my pleasure. And anybody who writes to me via Facebook or on email, I always answer my correspondence. And so, you know, if you're interested in this subject, I'd be glad to hear from you.
Joining me now is religion historian Adam English, author of The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus, The True Life and Trials of Nicholas of Myra. Adam, welcome.
Thank you so much, Walton, for having me on your show.
Talk about Saint Nicholas and the way he gained the reputation for giving gifts to people.
Saint Nicholas is a early 4th century bishop. His connection with gift-giving comes from a particularly wonderful story about him. Early on in his life, before he is made bishop, he is just a young man, has inherited a certain sum of money, and hears about a man in town who has 3 daughters and is on the door of destitution. They've become so desperately poor that the man is considering selling off his daughters. And Nicholas decides to do something about it. He bags up a bag of gold and in the middle of the night anonymously tosses it through the man's window. The money is found in the morning and used for one of the girls as a dowry so that she might marry out of her circumstance. He repeats the act 2 more times so that each of the other girls might be able to marry themselves out of poverty. And so it's a wonderful tale of generosity. And you can clearly see the connections with Santa Claus.
How long did it take for this association with Christmas to occur?
Well, you know, the association with gift-giving was, of course, there from the beginning. So that by the 1100s, nuns in France were making little toys and leaving them on the doorsteps of children and signing them from Saint Nicholas. But the connection with Santa Claus, that is a product of the early 19th century America, where prominent New Yorkers are trying to find some traditions, some roots that are European, and they're reconnecting with their Dutch heritage. And so to be Dutch was to celebrate St. Nicholas, Sinterklaas, to make St. Nicholas cookies and to give gifts on St. Nicholas Day. So by them retrieving St. Nicholas or Sinterklaas, and there you can see even the word morphing into Santa Claus, was all part of this attempt to create some traditions, to reconnect with some Dutch roots. And then it, in the American context, gets broadened out and becomes a universally loved tradition.
Mm-hmm. How much of the way we stereotypically visualize Santa Claus today, as well as the whole scene, the North Pole, the reindeer, the ho-ho-ho, how much of that was born of the Coca-Cola advertising campaign?
A good bit of it was, in terms of the visual image we think of Santa Claus having. It really is a product of the early 20th century, as artists are now trying to represent this new Americanized St. Nicholas and depict him warmly and nostalgically and inside the home. And so Haddon Sundblom, working for the Coca-Cola company, really has the classic picture that we think of, the rotund grandfather character who's jolly and cheerful and dressed in red from head to toe with the belt and the boots and everything. That really is a product of the Coca-Cola advertisements, and others were depicting a similar kind of image. And of course, you know, as you see that standard picture, you think of it in your mind, obviously there is almost nothing there that connects him with a Christian bishop. You know, he's lost the crozier staff and the mitre hat and the stole and, you know, everything that might connect him with the Christian faith. Although in Europe, most all of the European countries still celebrate St. Nicholas, and there you still see him very much in his bishop's garb.
Mm-hmm. You write also that St. Nicholas had real significance in church history. Would you comment a little bit about that?
When he was born, Christianity was a persecuted minority religion. By his death, it has not only been legalized, but it has become the favored religion of the empire. He oversaw a lot of that. He also attended the very famous Council of Nicaea, which your church history buffs out there will recognize as maybe the most important council in all of Christian history. Mm-hmm. He was part of that, arguing for the faith. It really is at that council that we finally really hammer out who is Jesus Christ. And, of course, if Christianity is anything, it is about Jesus Christ.
Right.
But, again, just to point out that he lived at a very critical moment in our church history.
Isn't it ironic that today a lot of people see Santa Claus as representing the materialistic side of Christmas, when in fact St. Nicholas represents just the opposite?
Although I would certainly add that from the very beginning of the early 19th century, he was even then connected with commercialism and advertisers and things like that.
Yeah.
But St. Nicholas, of course, gives us a model of charity, generosity, helping your neighbor out. And what I was really surprised to find was that St. Nicholas was also equally concerned with justice, social justice, civic justice. And so a lot of the other stories have him doing things that we would expect maybe a lawyer or a good politician or a judge doing. And that definitely surprised me. You know, we think about Santa Claus at the North Pole with his lists of naughty and nice. In that is an echo of this character trait that is there in the real St. Nicholas, as someone who is very concerned with naughty and nice, with virtue, and work tirelessly for social justice.
I've been speaking with Adam English, author of the new book, The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus, The True Life and Trials of Nicholas of Myra. Dr. English is Associate Professor of Theology and Philosophy at Campbell University Divinity School. It's a fascinating book, Adam, and I want to thank you both for writing it and then for being willing to come and tell the story of it on State of Belief Radio.
Welton, it's been an honor to be with you.
We first met Jerry DeWitt last year on this program, soon after he founded the Community Mission Chapel, a humanist congregation in Lake Charles, Louisiana. I was moved by his dedication to his members and by his warmth toward all people of all religious orientations, and I thought the Christmas season would be a great time to revisit his work. So I'm delighted to welcome Jerry DeWitt back to State of Belief Radio. Jerry, welcome back.
Well, it is totally my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's been over a year now since we first introduced you to our listeners. I just can't help but ask, how have things been going with the Community Mission Chapel?
Community Mission Chapel is doing very well. Probably its only disadvantage is me, and I say that in relationship to my constant travels. So I've not been able to put the energy into it like I would really like to, but we are growing, and we do have wonderful staff. And this December the 28th, we have an unbelievably wonderful event coming up where it's going to be a combination of the normal secular service along with a barbecue. You can't get together in the South without adding some food into the mix. And we're also going to have a fossil hunt for the kids. We're going to be having our service at someone's residence that has built their own park. And this park also contains thousands of fossils that have been planted in order to give children the ability to learn about fossils.
Jerry, is there a high point, an outstanding moment that you would share with us?
That's a really good question. Let me think about that for a second. I really think that the high point for me, and I'm sorry that this isn't very dramatic, but I think the high point for me on a very regular basis is to have people that are from the South in particular, that in whichever way life leads them to my book, they stumble across our story, they read it, they digest it, and then later on they write us and describe how the book gave them the courage to speak out, to express their own individuality, and to begin to live a life a little freer from maybe some limiting traditions. And so I think I have those high points almost on a daily basis.
There were news reports earlier this year about some disturbing harassment a family that was attending the chapel received. Would you be able to talk about that for a minute?
Sure. So to give you the short version of the story, CMC, Community Mission Chapel, has struggled to find a regular venue. And we've bounced around, and we've been bounced around from different venue owners. And in the process of this, one of our staff members who grew up and whose children still go to one of the local high schools in our area, this staff member had the idea of, hey, let's just use this high school's auditorium, because everybody uses it for lots of different things. And in the process of that, we really, really, really generated a lot of animosity with the believing community. They did not want these non-believers using their high school gymnasium in this fashion. And so, of course, all of that speaks towards a great misunderstanding as to what our mission is and what it is that we actually do. But that's normal. That's the state of our business. But in the midst of that, unfortunately, one of the absolute kindest, most inclusive families within our little secular community was targeted. And now we have to believe that they were targeted by someone that knew them personally and must have had some type of vendetta and used our services and this family's connection to our secular community as an excuse to try and intimidate these people and literally try to make them not be part of our community. They literally threw two different notes that were hand-delivered into this family's mailbox outside of their home, They threatened via these notes to do things to their children in order to try to save their children from the mom and dad's corrupt influence.
How has the relationship with the Lake Charles community evolved overall in this past year?
Now, this is something I am very proud of, and I will, maybe I'll rescind my earlier statement and say this has been a high point as well. Our goal from the very beginning has been to normalize, not just normalize atheism, because Community Mission Chapel is not about atheism. If it's about any one particular philosophy, it's really about humanism. And our goal, though, has been to normalize the non-believing or the secular community within the Deep South. And I feel like if you were to exclude this singular attack against this one family, I would say we've been really, really, really successful. We've been on the local news a couple of different times. Obviously, different news medias nationally and internationally have made a big deal out of what we've been doing, and no one has protested us. No one has physically assaulted us. And so, in some ways, maybe they're just trying to ignore us with the hope that we're going away, but I'm being a little more positive about it, and I think they're actually accepting our goodwill. So I'm thrilled about our place in the community right now.
Well, Jerry, it's the Christmas season. There's nowhere to hide from the commercial expressions of this time of the year. And I know that holds true of religious messages as well. How do you address that with your congregation?
So, you know, I love Christmas. I love Christmas. Now, sometimes when my family hears me say that, they challenge me on it because they know that financially I'm a Scrooge. And I really hate to have to spend money for no other reason than commercialism tells us to. But outside of that, I absolutely love Christmas. I love the Christmas season. I love the Christmas music. I love the colors, the decoration, the whole ambiance of Christmas. And so it's very easy to share the principles of Christmas or of the Christmas season with a secular congregation, because isn't it really always about family? You know, it just is. It's about family. Even for someone who's not married or doesn't have children, they're still going to connect with extended family and friends in a deeper and richer way, or at least the season is going to motivate them to attempt to. And so our secular congregation and our humanistic values has always been centered on family values, on the value of family, the value of relationship, along with the value of self-expression. And so it's extremely easy to deal with Christmas. Now, on a personal level, once a person has made this journey and they no longer belong to, you know, the traditions that they may have been brought up in and the way that those traditions relate to the Christmas holiday, once they work that out within themselves, then I think the real struggles for the non-believer is, what do I do with my immediate family who is going to try to enact some type of faith-based tradition? And especially, I think it may even be harder with extended family. When I go to the Christmas dinner with the grandparents, or I go to Christmas dinner or Christmas reunion with the extended family, and everyone's wanting to pray, you know, how do I deal with that? That's where I think more of the challenges with Christmas come up.
How do you personally keep from feeling alienated at this time of the year? I know your background is as an evangelical pastor. There must be some mixed feelings about all of this right now.
The only time that I have felt alienated has been particularly through, two places. I feel a little alienated during whenever it's time to say grace. Now, my personality causes me to simply sit there quietly. And I remember a couple of years ago, whenever all of this was still very new, my father-in-law, who's very, very gracious, a very, very generous person to me, he went along with what had become a tradition in our extended family, and that was for me as the minister to say grace at every event. And so obviously I wasn't in the position to do that anymore, but he still kind of fell into that habit. And so we went back and forth for a little while. He says, yeah, go ahead and say grace. And I'm like, no, it's your house. You do it. No, you do it. No, you do it. No, you do it. And finally he just turned to his wife and said, honey, you do it. she said grace. And I sat there, eyes still open, head not bowed, not trying to be, you know, impolite in any way, but also being true to my own conscience, where my son, who is also a non-believer and obviously 20 years younger than me, he made sure that he, you know, took a big swig of something at the same time that everyone was saying grace. So his self-expression was a little more outstanding than mine. I feel a little alienated there, and I feel a little alienated that the situation has evolved in such a way that I cannot comfortably go and celebrate. Say, for instance, one of the churches that I worked out of is only a couple of blocks from my home, and they have a fantastic Christmas program. Wonderful, wonderful Christmas program. Obviously, it's going to be Christ-centered, but at the same time, it's community-based and it's traditional singing, and I do wish that my story had made its way into the public arena in a slightly different way so that I could go and enjoy that service and enjoy that, you know, that local community without it being an issue. And so that does make me feel a little alienated. But I do believe that we all go out of our way to make up for that, and I think most of us are very successful with making up for it.
Jerry DeWitt is the founder of the Secular Community Mission Chapel in Lake Charles, Louisiana. He is the author of the book, Hope After Faith, An Ex-Pastor's Journey from Faith to Atheism. Jerry, it's great to talk with you again. I hope you have a happy new year and your congregation as well. Thanks again for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, happy new year to you and all of your listeners. And to everyone's great surprise, let me say I wish all of you a very Merry Christmas.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. A big thank you to listeners who've made a donation this past week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today as you consider your end-of-the-year giving plans. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief and share the stories that you find compelling. Share them with your friends. The same goes for Twitter. We're at twitter.com/stateofbelief. It's a great way for you to be an active part of getting these important voices to reach more people at a time when the noise in social media threatens to drown them out. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.